Well, good morning, everyone. Or rather, here it's good afternoon from a pretty grey and damp London this afternoon. So it doesn't look quite like my background today. So it's a real pleasure to speak to you all. And of course, it's one of the few positives that's come out of the pandemic. I think that we are there are many more opportunities to interact with people sort of long distance. So it's nice to do that. So as Neil said, today I'll be telling you something about how we can use all the past few years of excitement in gravitational wave astronomy to test the laws of gravity on cosmological distance scales. And we'll talk all about why we would want to do that and how we'll do that in a moment. I hope this talk is suitable for everyone. So some of you might be experts in this area, some of you might work on something completely different. Hopefully it's friendly for everyone. Apologies to the experts if I tell you things you know already. So you might recognize my title slide here as being the first 11 events that were found in the first two observing runs of the LIGO-Virgo detectors. So you've got the 10 binary black holes in the smaller panels, and of course the binary neutron star merger GW170817 in the larger panel down here. And for every event, you're seeing a spectrogram. So that's the spread of frequencies that's in the gravitational waveform. And you can see that chirping up towards merger. And then overlaid on that, there's a waveform model for that event. And if you really squint in the gray underneath, there's actually a cleaned version of the data stream as well. So these events are stacking up now, and there's a huge amount of science to come out of them. And what I want to tell you about today is, of course, one small piece of that science in the domain of fundamental physics. So there'll be three sections to this talk. We'll start off with just a general status update, what's going on with the detectors and with these gravity theories that we want to test. In the second section, we'll ask, what's the story so far? What can we learn from the gravitational wave detections that we actually have in hand? And in the third and final section, we'll look to the future and ask, what's next? What would we like to do as the number of gravitational wave events continues to increase? So this will mainly be a review talk. There'll be lots of other people's work in it, but I will sneak a little bit of my own work into the final part. On the right-hand side of the screen here, you have a picture of a painting by the physicist turned artist, Gregor Horndeschi. And usually I've used this painting before in talks, and I say to people, if you don't know who Horndeschi is, you will do by the end of the talk, etc. However, Horndeschi had the physics part of his career at the University of Waterloo. So perhaps this audience, more than any other, might be the best placed to know about Horndeschi already. Okay, but if you don't, you will do by the end of the talk. Okay, so let's start then with the general status update. So the LIGO detectors are currently offline. They are not taking data, and they were taken offline on the 27th of March earlier this year. Okay, and they were taken offline because of the pandemic and the safety of the people working there. Luckily, that was only about 1 month before they were due to come offline anyway at the end of their third observing run. And so they got through most of their third observing run, and there are 56 new detections. I think we're still awaiting the kind of full publications of those, but there is some data available online already. And what's supposed to be happening now is the detectors are supposed to be undergoing upgrades to improve their sensitivity and various other bits of engineering. And the fourth observing run was originally due to start in autumn 2021. Okay, now that's, I think, word on the street is that's going to be delayed now because of the pandemic. I don't actually know the latest date. That I don't think that's been announced, but if anyone does know, maybe they can tell me at the end. Okay, so that's what we have now. And you can see we've gone from 11 events in two observing runs, 56 events in the third observing run. So things are starting to stack up. But already we're thinking about the next generation of gravitational wave detectors, what we would call the third generation. And there's lots of different proposals on the table. I've got artists' impressions of two of them here. So in Europe, there's the Einstein telescope, which you can see has a very different configuration to the LIGO detectors. So it's this triangular configuration, and that actually changes and broadens out the shape of the sensitivity curve in quite an interesting way. There is also the Cosmic Explorer, which is sort of comparable to this, but more in a traditional LIGO configuration. That's the US proposal. And then in space, of course, there's LISA, the Laser Interferometer Space Antenna. So going to space allows the laser arms to go from sort of 4 or 10 kilometers to about 2.5 million kilometers. And that makes LISA sensitive to very low frequency gravitational waves. And that makes it the ideal instrument for looking at a very different population of sources to the ones we're seeing right now, which are, of course, the mass black holes at the center of galaxies. So the forecast detection rates for these third generation detectors are really pretty exciting. So the figure for the Einstein telescope is just under 1 million events per year, okay, which is a crazy number. And clearly the instrument could run easily for 10 years or more. For LISA, things are a bit different because LISA sources, massive black hole binaries, are obviously rarer in the universe and they take longer to merge, right? Their time scale is longer. So LISA will see many events that are not yet at the stage of merger, many systems that are not at the stage of merger. In terms of merger events, probably about 130, maybe 200 per year. Still a ballpark figure there, but as I say, a completely different source population. Okay, so things are looking really exciting on a 10 plus year time scale. We hope to be entering an era where gravitational wave astronomy is almost on a par with electromagnetic astronomy in terms of source populations and statistics.
Is the redshift range, you know, for both of these, like, similar, do you know?
For Einstein and LISA?
Yeah.
No, not quite. So Einstein telescope, most of those million events, I believe, and I will have to double check, are around up to around redshift 2, which is still, you know, obviously much higher than LIGO, and some small portion of those being considerably higher. For LISA, and we'll talk about this more shortly, in principle, LISA could see events up to redshift 20, which, I mean, is absolutely mind-blowing.
Great, then.
Okay. Great. So we're pushing out, okay, as well as the number of detections, that's an absolutely valid point, we're also pushing out the redshift horizon of our sources.
May I ask a question? So Einstein telescope, will it have better angular resolution than LIGO, and how much better?
Ooh, I don't have the exact figure for that right now. I have not seen, I don't know if the Einstein telescope without checking, I'm afraid. For LISA, the resolution gets down to about 1 degree square before in the period before merger. So there's a quite interesting evolution that obviously LISA can see things very early on. It can observe a system for years, and early on the localization is quite bad. But in the week before merger, it really rapidly starts decreasing and gets to about 1 degree square.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
All right, so this is what we're looking at. And as I say, I want to talk about how we can use these things to test the laws of gravity. Okay, now I am not going to spend a huge amount of time today motivating why it is we want to test the laws of gravity on cosmological scales, because I think everyone is familiar with the basic ideas here that extensions of GR affecting large scales are something people investigate as a dark energy candidate. So that's a big driver. Could they explain cosmic acceleration? People also look at these theories for their effects on large scale structure and ask, perhaps could they resolve certain parameter tensions we have in cosmology right now? And sometimes people also ask, could we actually get rid of the need for dark matter as well with one of these extensions of GR? Although that's a less common property of theories. Okay, and the theories I'll be talking about today then are designed to modify a weak field regime, the large scales of cosmology. And that implies that they are often designed to reduce to general relativity in other regimes, such as the strong field regime or the solar system, for example, what we would call a comparatively high density regime, because we have, of course, very good tests of GR in the solar system already. So many of these theories, at least the ones cosmologists are interested in, are built to have a property called screening mechanisms, which is essentially mathematical properties that cause this reduction, this suppression to GR in these regimes. And if I had another hour, I could sort of tell you all about screening mechanisms. I'm not going to go down that road today, so I'll just put the names of some of them on the slide. These might ring a bell from things that pop up on Archive, depending on your interests. So the reason I'm kind of explaining this weak field, strong field difference today is the kinds of theories I'll be talking about today will affect gravitational wave propagation, okay? And in general, today we won't be studying modified gravity effects on generation. So that is the actual inspiraling of sources in their last moments, because that's a problem for numerical relativity and also a different class of theories that people study those effects in. So the mental sort of picture, the cartoon for today, is you should think of both your gravitational wave source and us sitting in host galaxies, so nice, dense environments where screening is active and things look like GR. And it's really as gravitational waves travel across intergalactic space that they can potentially suffer the corrections I want to talk about today. Okay, so we're interested predominantly in propagation effects in this talk. Okay, and to talk about these propagation effects, I want to introduce a particular framework, which some of you may know already, which is Horndesky gravity. Okay, so we could talk about gravity theories in lots of different ways. There's many different modified gravity theories on the market. But for a single talk, we really need to focus on a particular family. And the family we're going to use is Horndesky. And in a nutshell, the Horndesky family is the most general family, the most general theory of gravity you can write down, that has one new fundamental scalar field, okay, and results in second order equations of motion. And that second order equations is really a sort of technical requirement that favors energetic stability. So the important point is anything that is gravity plus one scalar degree of freedom sits in this family, this class. Now, I decided not to show you the action for Horndesky gravity in full today because it's pretty messy and we don't need it for this talk. It's not super enlightening. So we just need to know that there is some big messy action you can write down that contains the metric G and this new scalar degree of freedom phi. And we'll couple that all to a standard matter sector. And today we'll take that to include sort of canonical dark matter. What we'll be more interested in is the cosmological perturbation theory that results from this Horndesky Lagrangian. Okay, so we can take the linearized field equations of this theory about an FRW background. Now, obviously, linearized theory certainly doesn't get you everything in cosmology, but it gets you quite a long way for some of our major observables. And when you take the linearized theory from Horndesky, what drops out is a set of five parameters. Okay, and we usually denote them with the letter alpha. So they get called the Horndesky alpha parameters. Okay, here they are, alpha K, alpha B, alpha M, alpha T, and alpha H. And the statement is, in this big class of theories, wherever you have a term in your linearized field equations that is different from GR, it appears with a coefficient that contains one or more of these alphas. So they are in some sense the descriptors, the operators that tell you about corrections to the GR field equations. Okay, and they would all be zero in lambda CDM. Now I'm calling them parameters, but that's a little bit misleading because as I've indicated on the slides, these objects are in fact functions of redshift, okay? So we call them parameters, but they're really functions. So let's meet them in a bit more detail. What are these five alphas? Well, they quantify these typical features of extensions of GR. So alpha T is a parameter that describes the deviation of the speed of gravitational waves in your theory from C. Okay, so we write the speed of gravitational waves, we'll call that CT, T for tensor mode, squared in this case as equal to one, i.e. The speed of light in our units, plus this quantity alpha T. And in principle, alpha T could be positive or negative, so we could have gravitational waves that travel slower or faster than the speed of light. And in this particular case, alpha T being positive, faster than C, doesn't mean a violation of causality, if that's kind of something that comes into your mind. We'll come back to this parameter shortly. Another important one for us will be alpha M. So alpha M tells us about the run rate of the effective Planck mass. So many extensions of GR will give you a gravitational coupling strength, a big G, that evolves with time. Okay, and that's equivalent to an effective evolving Planck mass. Okay, and that rate of evolution is encapsulated in alpha N. Alpha B is called the braiding parameter, and it quantifies an interaction between the kinetic terms of your metric and your new scalar field. Alpha K is the kineticity parameter, and it tells you whether that scalar field that's in your theory has a very canonical standard kinetic term or something really exotic, which can happen in these theories. And finally, alpha H is often called the beyond Horndesky parameter. So I'm not quite sure why it's alpha H. I mean, I guess alpha B was taken already. And it's a parameter which quantifies an extension of the original Horndesky family. So after the Horndesky theory was written down, it was discovered there is actually this extension that can be reached by doing a disformal transformation on your theory. Okay,
and a disformal.
Yes.
Sorry, can I ask something, Tessa? Sorry, this is Ruth here. Same time zone as you. Okay. It looks as if, you know, in terms of these alphas, most of them are actually, you know, independent of background, but the second one looks background dependent, the way you've written it, if H is the Hubble parameter. That looks very background dependent, whereas speed of gravitational waves presumably is not back. Do you see what I'm asking?
I guess that's a fair point. So we usually think of the alphas as being, as you're saying, quantifying the dynamics of perturbations, right?
Yeah, and the Lagrangian
ground dependent. This can be rewritten as d log a, and if I rewrite it in terms of that time variable, that absorbs the h, right, which makes that a little bit less explicitly background dependent.
Still an FRW though, isn't it?
Sure. Yes, so I am assuming an FRW background here. That is true.
I was just trying to think what would be a background independent equivalent, but okay, fair enough. I mean, I guess we are talking about cosmology, so fair enough.
Just to follow up, Ruth, I was going to ask something similar about the first. This is Latham, by the way. About the first parameter, I guess that the normal speed of light and this speed of light can't both be Lorentz invariant. I guess that the normal one is, and this one is the speed in the FRW rest frame. Is that right?
Right. So, yeah. That's essentially it. So normally how the sort of physical picture we give to this is when you have this extra scalar field in your theory, it's like creating a medium, right? And so now the light propagation cones, the geometry of those in your medium have changed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's usually how we interpret this having a different speed, at least particularly regarding causality, why it's not a problem for that. But perhaps I didn't answer your question there.
I think you pretty much did. I was just saying that I think only one of them can, only one of those two speeds can be Lorentz invariant. So I guess it's that, I guess it must be only one of those is invariant under the boosts that preserve the metric at a given point, and I guess it probably is the ordinary speed of light.
I would think so, yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you.
So maybe I can just follow up on this hi Tessa. These are not fundamental parameters of the Lagrangian. These are just what you care about for perturbations. I mean, I guess there are fundamental functions in the Lagrangian, and in fact, there are two-dimensional functions rather than one-dimensional functions. Is that correct? Like this omega and gamma that you got.
Right, so you're absolutely right. The version of Horndesky that you write down, the Lagrangian, has a different set of functions. And as you say, they're usually considered two-dimensional in that they depend on the scalar field and this other object X, which is like the kinetic, the scalar field. And that set of action level functions are mapped in a lengthy, but in principle, algebraically straightforward way to these alpha functions. So these aren't the fundamental objects, no, but they are the things that observables probe in the most direct sense. So that's why we work in terms of these, because they're the things that are easier to constrain. And in principle, you could kind of take your constraints on the alpha parameters and wrangle them back onto those fundamental functions.
Wonderful, thanks.
I have a comment to John Moffat, the father of scalar tensor gravity, of course, is the Jordan-Bransticki theory. Mm-hmm. Bransticki was published 56 years ago. So in that theory, in the so-called Jordan frame, photons move along non-geodesics. In fact, particles move along geodesics. And so in that case, except for pathological situations. The CT squared is 1. Also, all F of R theories, so-called, can be mapped into branch decay, except for some pathological cases.
Yes, that's certainly true. That's certainly true. And so F of R and Brans-Dickey are both limits. They both belong to this Horndesky class. What's not present in either of those two theories is the higher order derivative terms that were later discovered in things like the Galileon family of theories. So they sort of originated in DGP, and then the Galileon family of theories were built, these scalar field theories that look like they should give rise to higher order equations of motion, but actually by a sort of trick of cancellation, the equations of motion remain at second order. And that's what gives rise to a lot of the extra structure that's encapsulated in these parameters, essentially. Does that sort of fit with what you were saying?
Yes, thank you.
Can I add just one short question, follow up to Ruth's question? So the Planck mass here, effective, does that effective is both for a structure formation and a Friedmann equations, or is it a scale dependent?
Okay, so it's not scale dependent. That's the easiest part to answer. Because the way these alphas are defined, as you can see here, the scale dependence has essentially been factored out, and these are coefficients of terms that might be scale dependent. So these are redshift dependent only. Things get a little bit sticky when we try and compare the Planck's constant that, as you'll see a bit later, affects gravitational wave propagation, and the Planck's constant that affects, so the big G effectively in matter-matter, attraction between two matter sources. Those in principle can be different in some modified gravity theories, although in others they are the same, which is the closest thing that came to mind when you ask about the Planck's constant in the Friedmann equations and in structure formation.
Okay, so here you are treating them both as the same when you go to the model, I guess, building.
Yeah.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, all right. Any more? I will carry on for now, but you know, these are all great questions, so you know, please do continue to ask. All right, so I'd introduced you to these Horndesky parameters. And I'd made this final comment about the last one, that it quantifies this extended family of theories that are reached by a disformal transformation, which is something like this. Okay, and that's just a little bit important for later. Okay, and I'm going to encourage you to mentally just quickly snapshot these two here, so alpha M and alpha B. We're going to put them to one side and we'll come back to them shortly. But first, let's talk about what's happened with two of these other parameters, because two of these are quite well constrained already. Okay, and that's just from the data we have already, so things we've learned so far. All right, so let's talk about what has happened. So I think probably it's not a surprise to anyone for me to talk about GW170817, which I think everyone, everyone heard about in the coverage. So it doesn't need an introduction from me. And we have here the spectrogram from the LIGO-Virgo detectors, and the top and bottom panel here are gamma ray flux counts from the Fermi and integral spectrographs. Okay, and the well-known story is, of course, that the start of the gamma ray counterpart arrives at Earth 1.7 seconds after, excuse me, the merger moment in the gravitational wave signal. And that simple fact in turn allows us to bound the speed of propagation of the gravitational waves. Okay, and in my language, remember that that potential difference in speed was given by this alpha t parameter. Okay, and I've reminded you there that it is, strictly speaking, a function of redshift. So the calculation here is really straightforward because the source was quite close by. You can do the time of flight calculation. I won't go through the steps, but you find that that difference in arrival time is related to the distance to the source, which in this case was 40 megaparsecs roughly, and our alpha t parameter. And plugging in the numbers, you get a bound on the alpha t parameter, which is around 10 to the minus 15. Okay, so a really, really tight bound. And you can express this as a two-sided bound if you want. I'm just going for the simple one with the absolute magnitude. And that's a bound at the redshift of the source, which was 0.01, so pretty low redshift. Okay, and unfortunately, this is only one data point. So strictly speaking, of course, with one data point, we can't rule out the possibility that alpha t does something really crazy at high redshifts and then reduces to be under this incredibly tight bound at low redshifts. Now, that would be very fine-tuned, and so I'm not saying that I think that's likely, but with one data point, there's always going to be loopholes. Now, this bound is actually the most optimistic one, because it assumes the sort of gravitational waves from the merger instant and the gamma ray photons set off at the same time. Okay, and of course that doesn't actually have to be true. Neutron star mergers are very messy things. And if you include a more realistic delay between those things setting off, it weakens the bound by two orders of magnitude. Okay, so 10 to the minus 13 is more conservative, but it's still an incredibly tight bound, right? And this single event had a huge impact on this landscape of dark energy theories that people were constructing. Okay, so I have a kind of traffic light system going on here. And all the things in white here are the names of particular gravity theories. We don't need to know any of their details today. But the things in red were essentially completely ruled out by this measurement because they are unable to give gravitational waves that travel at sea. Things in green are completely consistent with the measurement. They always have gravitational waves traveling at sea. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, they aren't constrained by other cosmological observables, but they're not constrained by GW170817. And the things in the middle here are sort of constrained but not eliminated. So there might now be some restriction on their internal parameter spaces. Okay, so this was big news. Going forward, anyone who's going to try and build a new gravity theory has to think about how they're going to be consistent with these results. Okay, and that kind of input that sculpts or confines theoretical possibilities is a useful step forward.
Can I just add a comment?
Sure.
I have to advertise my modified gravity theory, scalar tensor vector gravity. It's been published that theory does get into the green side.
Sure. Okay, good. So there's another one to add to the green then.
Yeah.
So there is a caveat to these results, which is important to point out. So it was pointed out by Durham and Melville about a year after the original announcement. And they argue that in some of these scalar tensor theories, we perhaps should naturally expect this alpha t parameter to return to zero at some energy scale. Okay, and they argue that's necessary for the theory to have a Lorentz invariant UV completion. Okay, of course, we don't know what that UV completion is, but for, they argue that we should expect it to be Lorentz invariant. And they, in a sort of toy example, try and find a ballpark scale at which this might happen. And they argue that in this Horndesky family, this this cutoff scale could be as low as 260 hertz when expressed as a frequency. Okay, it doesn't have to be that low, but it could be that low. And that's what's illustrated in the plot here. So they're showing this speed of gravitational waves. The color is kind of corresponding to increasing deviations from GR up towards the red. And you see that all these models they consider that give a non-unity speed at lower frequencies then return to being one essentially just below the LIGO band. Okay, so what this caveat means, at least as far as I see it, is that we're going to need to check these results when we have LISA or perhaps with the pulsar timing array with lower frequency data. Okay, maybe this isn't happening, but we need to be sure. We need to close that loophole. And so until then, we should bear that in mind.
So can I ask a question about this? So, I mean, it's hard to see it in this picture, but I mean, 10 to the minus 13 is a tiny number, and 200 hertz is not really, I mean, it's what LIGO does see. So does it actually satisfy that the LIGO bound?
You're asking?
Yeah.
Well, I guess what they're saying is, so this was a counterclaim to people coming out and saying, you know, we've bounded 10 to the minus 13, and it's kind of crazy to think that there's any wiggle room around that that isn't incredibly highly fine-tuned. And really what these authors were arguing is that it's not actually, potentially it's not actually as fine-tuned as it appears. Right, so they found a mechanism which could be consistent with that. I mean, are you asking literally on the scale of this plot, is that 10 to the minus 13? Probably it isn't, but I think this plot is for illustrative purposes rather than being, you know.
But I mean, I think it's the problem is that you don't actually have a parametric suppression here, because 200 hertz is actually seen by LIGO. So
yeah.
That frequency should be basically alpha t should go to zero. So it might be 10 to the minus 2, but that's, so basically I'm saying that it doesn't seem that this is enough to explain the small number or the fine tuning.
Okay. I mean, to be clear, I mean, you know, read the technical details of this paper, but the argument is quite general. General, but perhaps slightly abstract. So it only talks in terms of ballpark numbers rather than building a precise theory and really studying a given theory in huge amounts of detail. So no, good question.
I appreciate the nature of that, but it doesn't seem that it solves the problem. I mean, it might go in the right direction, but not by enough.
Okay. I would have to revisit that paper, which has been some time now, to see if there's a kind of a counterclaim, if you like.
I had to back up Yeush. There are very strong bounds of the violation of Lorentz invariance in particle physics, extremely strong for years now. So they have to be taken into account here at these frequencies.
Alright. Shall I move on? Okay. I'll move on for now. So that was alpha t. I'll try and tell you very quickly about the second thing that happened, because I want to get on to the last section. But so alpha t was more or less constrained, subject to these kind of loopholes and caveats which may or may not be as watertight as people claimed. The second thing that happened in this story regards this alpha H parameter, okay, which initially seemed to be untouched by these measurements. Theories with non-zero values of alpha H seem to survive, no problem. And then again, about a year after the actual merger announcement, this paper appeared, and these authors claim that in the extended beyond Horn-Desky family, so the extension of the family that has a non-zero value of alpha H, that gravitational waves can decay into dark energy. Okay, and they actually consider this at the level of gravitons decaying into bosons of this of your dark energy scalar field, which will kind of indicate gravitons with gamma and bosons with pi. And I'm not going to go into the technical details of this paper because it's a pretty thick field theory paper. But to sort of summarize, perhaps one of the key results. They argue that the decay rate for this, the dominant channel here, which is the first one, is sufficiently large that we should be worried about this, right? That the fact that we're seeing gravitational waves coming from hundreds of megaparsecs away now, clearly not decayed away into dark energy, suggests this can't be happening. There is a bit of a loophole because the decay rate actually depends on the speed of sound in your dark energy speed of sound for your dark energy bosons. And if you really try again, you can finely tune a theory such that CS squared is one, and then of course this decay goes to zero by Lorentz invariance. But again, sort of the general argument that that's finely tuned and doesn't happen would seem to suggest that this alpha H parameter can't be significant, right? Otherwise this decay would take place. I'll skip that. The number they come up with, and as I say, technical details are in here, is that this alpha H parameter has to be less than 10 to the minus 10. Okay, that is the bound they obtain just from the fact that we don't appear to have gravitational wave decay going on. So this was another kind of development in the story, and it was quite a dramatic 2 years, right? We went from having this full five-dimensional parameter space to explore to having this parameter more or less ruled out or constrained to be very small. This parameter constrained to be very small, and then three left. And that sort of starts raising the question, could we actually complete the job, right? Could we bound these three parameters as well? And either we find something amazing and, you know, you found dark energy or modified gravity, or if you don't, then that's actually quite an important step forward for the literature, right? If you can say you've completely tested this big space of scalar tensor theories. So what I want to talk about in my third and final section, and I'll try and speed up a little bit so I don't run too much over, is some ideas on how we might bound these two parameters. Okay, and these were the two I asked you to kind of mentally snapshot. So it was the Planck mass run rate and the scalar. And we won't talk about alpha k today because this parameter is the hardest one to bound as far as we can figure out at the moment, because it doesn't seem to affect cosmological observables on a sub-horizon scale. So it's there in the equations, but when you take a look at the scale of a galaxy survey, so something that's significantly smaller than the cosmological horizon, the terms containing alpha k drop out. Okay, and that makes it, on one hand, unimportant, but also hard to measure. Okay, so we'll talk about these two. Okay, so this is the sort of what's next section. And in order to talk about this, we want to think briefly about gravitational wave propagation. So I've got an equation here that describes a gravitational wave. That's our spin 2 perturbation Hij propagating on an FRW background in GR. Okay, and this is a wave equation. So primes are derivatives with respect to conformal time. And I've gone to Fourier space. So my spatial derivatives have already become wave numbers. And we know, of course, in reality, there are the two plus and cross polarization modes hanging out in here, but we don't need to worry about them at the moment. So it's a damped wave equation because this friction term here damps the wave, and that depends on the Hubble factor. So the fact that your wave is traveling across an expanding universe will dampen its amplitude. So that's what happens in GR. Let's ask what can happen to this equation when we go to extended theories of gravity. Okay, and the answer is a whole bunch of things. So I've added in four terms and I've colored them in to sort of guide the eye. And these terms are all representing ways in which this equation can be changed in extensions of GR. And I should stress, I'm not talking about a particular theory of gravity here. This is just a kind of template. So you'll notice that friction term has been modified. And in particular, it's picked up a correction that depends on alpha n, which was our Planck mass run rate. The speed of gravitational waves we've talked about already. We can also allow the graviton to have a mass, which it does in some theories. There can be a non-zero source term on the right-hand side of this equation. That would be zero in GR. And finally, we can have extra polarization modes. So instead of the usual two plus cross, we can have up to six polarization modes in some theories. So these are all the kinds of things we could go looking for. And they're sort of in varying states of constraint and relevance right now. So we've talked about the propagation speed already. That's very well constrained from GW170817. We haven't talked about it today, but the mass of the graviton is pretty well bounded from solar system tests, okay, to some small number. Conversely, the presence of additional polarization modes is really quite hard to measure at present because of the way the LIGO detectors are aligned to a high degree that makes them quite insensitive to polarization. So that kind of thing should be possible in future when experiments like CAGRA come online and we have some different baselines. Some of these terms are more common than others. So things like this non-zero source term, it's actually pretty rare. There's only bigravity theories are the main kind of trigger for that kind of term, but it's not super generic. Whereas something like this modification to the friction is really generic. So lots of theories of gravity will give you some kind of correction here. And so it's this one that I want to talk about just a little bit more because it's perhaps one of the most powerful and the most hopeful parts to constrain over the coming years. So let me take away the others so we can just focus on this one. And we need to understand what does this modified friction do to our gravitational wave? So we can get an answer to that by doing a sort of really quick and dirty solution of this equation. We can pull off the indices into a polarization tensor just to make our lives easy. And we can write the remaining object H as some GR value modified by some factors. Okay, so a modification to the amplitude, we'll call it B, and a potential phase change C. And you can plug this in and do a sort of WKB solution. And you'll find that in fact, there's no phase shift, so C is zero, but there is a change in amplitude. Okay, and you get the following solution for B. And that change in amplitude is an exponential that depends on the integrated behavior of that alpha M term. Okay, so that's what the change in amplitude to GR is. In order to use that, of course, we need to know what the GR expression for the amplitude is. And of course, that's a really well-known bit of physics. So at lowest PN order, which is all we're working at today, the amplitude for both your polarizations would have the following form. Okay, depends on the chirp mass to some power, depends on the frequency to some power. And importantly for us today, depends inversely on the luminosity distance of the source. Okay, and the luminosity distance in a flat cosmology is helpful to think of as essentially just the co-moving distance multiplied by a factor of 1 plus z. And we've said that what's going to happen when we go to our extended theory of gravity is we're going to multiply through this correction factor. So you can probably kind of see what's going to happen here is when we multiply through that factor, it is quite naturally absorbed into a redefinition of the effective distance that sits in the denominator here. Okay, so now we have an effective luminosity distance for our gravitational waves that is different from the standard luminosity distance, the ones that photons would experience, by some exponential factor that depends on our modified gravity effects. And that means if we can hope to measure both these distances, the one on the left from gravitational waves, the one on the right from a counterpart, say, then we might hope to bound this factor in the middle. So let me just show you that ratio of our two effective distances then more visually. Okay, so I'm plotting their ratio here for a range of Horndesky models. So I'm playing around with that alpha m parameter. You can ignore the second column here for now. And behind the scenes, I've sort of assumed some time dependence, but this is just for illustrative purposes. Okay, and what you can see is that ratio can become potentially significantly different from one at high redshift, because this is a cumulative effect. So I've got on here some mock data. I've got one real data point, which of course is GW170817. It's only standard siren we've detected to date, at least confidently detected to date. And I've got here a mock sample of 100 more events like GW170817. So something that the LIGO detectors might find over the next 5 years or so, or maybe slightly longer. And you can see these points are at quite low redshift, relatively speaking, which means they may struggle a bit to detect the slip in these curves, right? The difference from one. Whereas something like the LISA standard sirens, because they are at much higher redshift, that gives them a greater degree of sensitivity to this ratio, to this cumulative effect. So maybe there will be something that can be done with LIGO data, but LISA data certainly looks like a really promising avenue for this. And so we want to ask the question, how well could we bound our remaining Horndesky parameters with LISA data? Okay, and in order to do that, you have to generate a mock catalog of LISA events. And that's something that I've spent a large fraction of the past year doing. And I think in the interest of time, I'll skip some of the details of how you go about doing that. So excuse me if I skip a few slides. Perhaps one of the most important things to tell you is that there's quite a large degree of uncertainty in the underlying population of massive black holes and how they form. And there's several different, multiple different sort of candidate theories for how massive black hole seeds are produced in the early universe. And these lead to quite significant differences for the predictions for how many events LISA might detect. So I'm just comparing two models here. We won't sort of go into the physics underlying them, But one's called POP3, one's called DELAY. And this is for a 4-year LISA mission. And they're color-coded, so each point here is a detection, and they're color-coded by their SNR, so the signal-to-noise. And you can see that in some population models, you'll get of order 600 merger events in 4 years, whereas some, like the DELAY model, will only give you 30 events. So clearly, you might expect that to have quite a significant impact on how well you can test gravity, just purely from the number of data points you've got to work with. Another thing you have to think about is how many of these events are actually going to have an electromagnetic counterpart that I might detect, which was necessary in order to measure the standard luminosity distance, so you could compare it to the gravitational wave one. So again, this is something that goes into the sort of detailed modeling of these underlying source populations. But the ballpark figures that come out are probably only something like 10% of these events will actually have a detectable electromagnetic counterpart. Okay, and that's what I'm showing here with my catalog in pale blue. But the ones in dark blue are the only ones that we can use, because they're the ones that have been selected in this realization to have a counterpart. Okay, so there's all the sort of astrophysical modeling you have to worry about, but I'll be a bit brief about that today in the interest of time. You also have to think about the inclination of your sources, but I'll leave that for another day. Okay, so the final question we really wanted to answer was, how well can we bound these two remaining parameters? And I've talked a fair bit about how the gravitational wave luminosity distance bounds alpha n. I haven't sort of talked a lot about it today, but standard cosmological probes like the CMB and large scale structure bound alpha m, but also that alpha b parameter that we wanted to measure. Okay, so it makes sense to combine your gravitational wave data with things like the CMB. And you're seeing here that a Horndesky model with both those parameters switched on can actually provide a pretty good fit to the Planck CMB data, but might give some hugely discrepant prediction for the growth rate of structure. So it's useful to put together all your data sets to break these degeneracies. So I'll throw in a load of EM data, skip the details of that for now, and show you the final results. So this is the sort of headline forecast for how well you might bound these two remaining parameters. And what you're seeing here is a two-dimensional bound, alpha M on the y-axis, alpha B on the x-axis. And the blue contour in the background here is showing the bound that would be given by the large scale structure data alone. And I say large scale structure, I really mean large scale structure plus CMB, so the standard EM data. In green, we add that mock sample of LIGO events, 100 things like GW170817. And they don't really change the picture that much because, as we said, they're at quite low redshift. But when we add in the LISA data, that really helps shrink these contours down in the Y direction, right? Because they're sensitive to that alpha N parameter. Okay, and the actual numbers are over here if you're really interested. And you can see that there's some sort of unusual shape going on in this contour, and we know why that is. The lower bound here is a stability bound. So models that have alpha parameters below this suffer from ghosts. So we kind of cut them out as a theoretical prior. And then there's a bound from the large growth of large scale structure, which is kind of squashing in from the top here. And then it's the gravitational waves that squeeze in the Y direction. So that's where the shape has come from. So the headline bound is about 0.1, maybe slightly larger for alpha B. And the final thing that I need to do is give you some context to that. How good is that as a bound? Skip that. So if this is our forecast bound, how well does that actually compare? And so if you try to bound these alpha parameters with just one binary neutron star from LIGO, you get a band of about 10. So it's really huge. If you put in 100 of those events, you're down to about order unity. That's about the same as the current large scale structure data can do already by itself. So the gravitational waves aren't really adding anything new there. However, of course, we shouldn't really talk about current large scale structure data. We should try and think about the large scale structure data we'll have at the time of third generation gravitational wave detectors. Now, we can't actually see that far into the future, but we can talk about the next generation of large-scale structure surveys, what we call stage 4, for example. And those are expected to bound the alphas to about 0.2 by themselves. And there's some work here that shows that for LSST. So what we really want to do is bound the future gravitational wave data and the future EM data. And I don't actually have that number today. That's a work in progress. But the educated kind of ballpark figure, we would expect to get at least a factor of 2, and maybe if we're lucky, another order of magnitude out of that bound. And so you'd be bounding your alphas to about 10 to the minus 2. Okay, so it's not a 10 to the minus 13 bound. In fact, I think the days of that are over. I think that was a really special case. And I think from here on, it is going to be more at this kind of level. But hopefully that is still enough. I think it should be enough to sculpt the direction of theory, as we said. And that's really what we want to do here. If we've bounded all the alphas to at least 10 to the minus 2 or below, and we don't find anything, I think we're in a situation where hopefully people will start moving on from those kind of models. It might promote new ideas about the best way to build extensions of GR that are viable and have interesting phenomenology. Okay, I am slightly over time, so apologies for that. I will leave you with my sort of visual summary of the alphas. So I introduced you to these 5 parameters. I told you how alpha T is more or less constrained, how alpha H is more or less constrained. And we said that this one has essentially no impact on current observables. And I hopefully convinced you that gravitational wave luminosity distances hold important extra information on alpha M. Okay, and I raised the possibility that maybe we can either we find something or we close off this parameter space. Just a final comment that there's actually lots of really nice astrophysics that goes into this kind of analysis. I come from a cosmology background, a sort of a modified gravity background, but it's actually been really fascinating to learn just how much we don't know about the populations of massive black holes, for example, and all the big discoveries that are still to come in those areas. All right, I will leave it there and happily take more questions if you have some. Thanks very much for listening.
Okay, great. Thanks, Tessa. Yeah, that's all. I'll give a round of applause. Okay, great. So we are a bit over time, but Tessa agreed very kindly to stick around for a bit at least, you know, to answer questions. Okay, great. So I see that Alex already has his hand raised. Go ahead, Alex. You can unmute yourself.
Yeah. Hi. So I was wondering, in your plot with the LSS bounds, it seemed like the current LSS data was mostly RSD, but then the future, you were mainly talking about LSST weak lensing. So is your sense that the weak lensing is going to be much better than future RSD from DESI or like post-DESI experiments?
Right. So good eye, good spot there. So it is definitely true what you said, that the RSD are the most strongly constraining thing on the EM side at the moment, and that lensing was not included in the constraints I did, but was in the Alonzo plot. Lensing could be an incredibly powerful probe if we can figure out how to sensibly treat the nonlinear regime of these theories, which is a big problem right now. So today I've just worked entirely in terms of these alpha parameters, and I said they were the linearized modified gravity parameters. But of course, for lensing, you really have to worry about things that are at a significantly nonlinear scale. And people are building, and people are trying to work out all the machinery needed to take these Horndesky theories to that, to at least to a quasi nonlinear regime, let's say that. But that's still under development. Yeah. So if we can do that, then lensing could take over from RSD. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, yeah.
Great.
Can I ask, make a comment? You didn't cover the issue of testing modified gravity with black hole mergers and spiraling. So I'm just throwing you this in. In 1972, Hawking proved that Bransticki black holes are the same as general relativity black holes, both for spherical and actually symmetric stationary solutions, given flat space asymptotic condition. This was extended to extended Bransticki theory, like Horndesky, by Fararoni and Sartorius in 2011. So it's important to know that the black holes and these scalar tensor theories are the same as GR. People tend to forget this. Hawking's proof is correct, by the way.
Sure. So, of course, studying black holes in extended theories of gravity is a hugely important area. What I was doing today and the effects that I was focusing on today were all things that would happen to those gravitational waves once they have left the source region and are traveling towards us. And in fact, I was indeed assuming that the source black holes themselves, or the source objects, were described by GR and were in spiraling as per GR. So in fact, we kind of need that to be the case for these kinds of tests to work. And that was exactly what I was saying at the beginning with the screening mechanisms. Now, there are some very different kinds of theories that affect the strong field regime in fascinating ways. And they're also really interesting, perhaps less so for cosmology often, but more as you know, strong field changes to GR. But that's you know, more a problem for tackling often with other techniques, such as numerical relativity, for example. So what I did today was actually consistent with what you're saying.
Very good. Thank you for a nice talk.
Any further questions for Tesla?
Well, maybe just to follow up on that. So is the statement that are there any claimed bounds on these other parameters that compete with the ones that you have mentioned but involve the strong field regime, or but you just didn't talk about them, or at the moment is the claim that, you know, for example, modifications to the binary and spiral do not offer competitive bounds on these parameters?
So the claim is that modifications to the in-spiral don't offer competitive bounds on these parameters, but do offer really interesting bounds on all kinds of other tests of GR, right? So,
Okay.
So dipole radiation, graviton dispersion relations, etc.
Okay. Could you remind me, at the beginning, were these five parameters selected because they were the five sort of free functions that appear in a general Horndesky theory?
Yeah, at the level of the field equations, and as someone mentioned, Nash mentioned, we could actually map these back onto the Lagrangian parameters that describe Horndesky.
So you're saying that Horndesky theories don't end up having a big effect on the in spiral? Is that the idea, or am I misunderstanding that?
That effect, if it exists, is not encapsulated by what I've talked about today, because I've been working with the linearized theory. So to understand that, someone would need to actually simulate an in spiral in Horndesky gravity, which, as far as I'm aware, has not been done yet.
Okay.
As I say, many parts of this parameter space have a screening mechanism, which means we wouldn't expect that to be a relevant question. However, there are parts of the Horndesky family that don't have a screening mechanism, and those would be the parts that would be interesting to study.
Okay, thank you.
I just want to repeat that if one looks into this issue of inspiring black holes, you should read the paper by Farrioni and Sartorius, because they did the extension of Horndesky theories with scalar fields. And they proved that you still get GR black holes.
But John, aren't those generalizations of the no-hair theorems? Aren't those only for stationary configurations?
They're for stationary solutions like Kerr or Schwarzschild.
So you might still wonder whether whether a highly dynamical system like an inspiraling binary would be very different.
Well, you can, if you relax the condition of asymptotic flat space, then you open up Pandora's box of possibilities, because you're embedding the black hole in cosmology, and all bets are off. I mean, there's a huge number of possibilities. But it's very speculative, in my opinion.
Okay.
So in the interest of time, why don't we stop here? So let's thank Tessa again for a fantastic talk.